This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. Today, I'm delighted to have in the studio with me Alejandro Juarez, an immigrant rights activist from California. Alejandro Juarez, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I'm very interested in finding out more about you and your work. Tell me a little bit about your background.
Sure. Well, as you said, I'm an immigrant rights activist from Northern California. I got started in this work just a few years ago after graduating from college. I went up to Oregon State and you know, obtained my master's in public policy. Before that, I studied in California and did my undergrad work in anthropology and history. I really got involved in this issue because I think it hits home. Both my parents are migrants from Mexico. They came in the 1970s, and they're still doing farm work or agricultural related work in California. And so, you know, all these issues that are affecting the immigrant community, you know, affect us very personally. So that's why I really am passionate about this work and really got involved with it.
And what was it like growing up in that family? Did you guys have to move all the time?
Well, my parents, for the good part of my life, my parents still did the back and forth trips of coming to the U.S. During harvest season. And, you know, they would pick fruit, you know, all kinds of fruit from grapes to peaches to apricots, and would usually head back to Mexico in the fall or when the season ended. And it wasn't until I was about 12 or 13 that they actually settled down in California. And so, yeah, I mean, I consider myself lucky because I, you know, grew up or had half of my childhood in Mexico, and that allowed me to, for example, go to school, experience that kind of life, and maintain the language, actually, because I know that there's a lot of Latinos or Hispanics that come, you know, second generation and lose it, you know, or they can read or write it. And so I'm lucky enough to still hold on to that, to still have that.
And did you do work in the fields yourself?
I did. I started, you know, when I was in high school, I would go and, you know, to help out the family in the summers. So most of the jobs, agricultural jobs that I've been involved with is with peaches, sorting peaches in the summer, or picking apricots, things like that. And even when I was in college, you know, those summers where you just can't find the work, that was sort of like the alternative that was always there. My dad has been a foreman on a farm for the last few years. So I could always go with dad to the farm and make some money in the summers.
And were you the first person in your family to go to college?
No. I have a large family. I have five older brothers and a younger sister who's also actually involved in this organizing work. An older brother of mine was the first one to go to college. He wasn't able to finish during his first attempt, I would say, because, you know, he dropped out, he got married, he had family, but he returned back to school not long ago and also has a master's. He has a master's in history. So
I'm speaking with Alejandro Juarez, an immigrant rights activist from California. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm the editor at The Progressive Magazine. You're listening to Progressive Radio. You got your master's at Oregon State, I read, and it had something to do, tell me if I'm wrong, about agriculture in Mexico, and then it must have dealt with NAFTA. You must have dealt with that a little bit. Explain.
Yeah, originally I had planned to do my master's thesis on immigration, but I found that it was, one issue led me to the other and then to the other. And so what I ended up doing was focusing on a very particular agricultural subsidy in Mexico. It's called Pro Campo. And I headed down to Mexico during this work and actually interviewed campesinos. A campesino is a subsistence farmer. And I interviewed them. What I wanted to find out was whether this subsidy had helped them be more competitive now that NAFTA was passed in 1994 and that basically the Mexican market, the Mexican market was opened up to imports, foreign imports. That was the original goal of the subsidy. Back then the president and these policymakers championed it as, a form to help those subsistence farmers be more competitive with, agribusiness from the U.S., from Canada, and farmers from these countries. What I found was that instead of their livelihoods improving after NAFTA, they have actually gone down. Their poverty levels have skyrocketed. A lot of them can't afford to farm their land anymore because it's just not profitable for them anymore. They can't make a living. And this is due to free trade, to NAFTA in particular, because what has happened is that with this agreement, not only Mexico, but the U.S. and Canada have dropped their barriers. And so it gives agribusiness free rein to go into Mexico, for example, and dump corn. Now, agribusiness can afford to sell their corn at a lower price in places like Mexico because they get subsidies here anyway. So they're not losing. So in Mexico, since NAFTA, since 1994, the latest figures that I've seen is that 2 million campesinos have been displaced from their land.
Well, what happens to them? Where do they go?
Well, what oftentimes happens is what academics call step migration. And so if a farmer can no longer farm his land, has to sell it or has to just kind of focus on some other form of making a living, they oftentimes go into the cities. Now, we've seen this rural to urban migration for a very long time. And in Mexico, there are, a lot of cities that have just grown in the last decade. They're congested, basically. And what these farmers often find is that they do move into the city, but then, they're so poor that they have to live in these shanty towns around the city, or they can't find work. And so when it doesn't work out for them in the cities, then they cross the border. And we see this, happen not only to rural Mexicans coming here, but also urban Mexicans, people from Mexico City or, Guadalajara, other cities like that are also not finding work in their countries and are forced to come to the U.S.
Do you think it's ironic that people have been pushing free trade and then those are some of the same people who are upset about immigration?
Exactly, yeah. And just a few weeks ago, Congress passed another couple of free trade agreements, this time with Colombia, with South Korea. Yet at the same time, they want us to believe that they really care about the fact that Americans are losing jobs and we can't make a living. Our living standards are going down. These free trade agreements, what they do also is they encourage companies and corporations to move overseas. Because they're looking for cheap labor. They're looking to maintain their profits while they cut their expenses in either, you know, labor costs or material costs. So, we lose jobs here too. And so it's very hypocritical, I think, that, you know, on the one hand, we're being told by the current administration that they're really working on it and they really, you know, want to pass legislation that will help us. And at the same time, they're still signing these trade agreements.
Speaking with Alejandro Juarez, an immigrant rights activist from California. This is Progressive Radio that you're listening to. It's strange, this free trade idolatry, because it's totally bipartisan. It's one of the real bipartisan things in this country. Mm-hmm. Everyone talks about how great bipartisanship is. I'm not a big fan of it, because look, you had Bill Clinton and H.W. Bush and Bush Jr. and Obama pushing these free trade agreements. Doesn't seem to matter
who's
in power, which mm-hmm. party's in power.
Yeah, and I mean, the sort of, if you want to call it the idea or the initiative of NAFTA, for example, took place under the Bush Senior administration. And in Mexico, that was when President Salinas was in power. And, but because Bush Senior didn't get reelected, he wasn't able to come back and actually pass NAFTA. So NAFTA was passed under the Clinton administration. And if you go back and do some research, you'll see how, both Clinton and Gore just championed it as, you know, it's going to create really good jobs for Mexicans and it's going to make the U.S. more competitive and this and that. And we've seen the complete opposite since then.
And one of the ways, if people are really concerned about immigration, is to help the economies of Central America and Mexico.
Right.
Instead of devastating them, which this new free trade agreement with Panama is going to do, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, that's actually, you know, a very good point, because we hear these arguments here from, you know, conservatives or right wings, the Tea Party, for example, you know, of Mexicanos and others are coming here and taking our jobs, or why don't they just stay home and do something in their countries? And one of the points that I make when I hear these arguments is that, well, we need to look at ourselves and our government, because a lot of the reasons why people migrate to the U.S. is because of our foreign policy towards other countries. NAFTA is just one example specific to Mexico. But, you know, other more glaring examples, I think, is, direct military intervention. You know, we've seen that in the 80s in Central America, in El Salvador, and in Guatemala, and in Nicaragua. And that's also a process that displaces people. More recently, we've seen it in Iraq and Afghanistan. And what do you think that those people are trying to do? They're trying to survive, but they can't in their own countries because of the violence. And, you know, if they don't go to other countries, they might end up here. So these are processes that we always seem to ignore in this country. We try to address immigration and immigration reform and just think about what we can do here, you know, build bigger walls on the border, or implement very repressive programs as Obama has done in the last couple of years, but we fail to address the root of the cause if we don't look at our foreign policy.
Speaking with Alejandra Juarez, she's an immigrant rights activist from California. You just talked about or mentioned Obama's repressive immigration policies. Spell those out.
Sure. I mean, some of these have been in place in the books for, you know, decades now, some of these, but haven't really been implemented. So, for example, E-Verify. E-Verify is a program that forces employers to run your information when you get hired. More specifically, your social security number with federal databases. But that, you know, E-Verify was actually passed back when Reagan was president. But it was just there. There weren't a lot of employers who implemented it. There wasn't really an effort from the federal government to make employers implement it. And that was due to these interests lobbying for it not to be implemented. But really after, during the second term of Bush Jr., we started to see those being used more and more. Under Obama, they have been expanded. And they have been revamped in the sense that a lot of these, if they had kinks in them, they're trying to make them more effective. So E-Verify is one program, but we also have another one called 287G. What 287G does is that it allows ICE, which is the Immigration and Customs Enforcement, to contract with local law enforcement and train local law enforcement to act as ICE agents.
Is this also called Secure Communities? Is that one and the same, or are those kind of separate?
Well, Secure Communities, Secure Communities is somewhat secretive. We know that it specifically deals with databases, with the sharing of information. So, you know, for example, in Northern California, where I'm from, we're seeing a lot of these programs being implemented, and the way that they are affecting the immigrant and Latino communities, for example, is, you know, if you have a mother who is undocumented and is driving her child to either daycare or school, and, you know, either has a broken taillight or does, you know, something, and is stopped by the police. Well, the police under 287G have the right to ask for her papers. If she doesn't have her papers, she can be arrested and taken to the local jail. Her car can be impounded.
And what happens to her kids then?
Well, that's an issue that we've been holding forums in certain communities, and for example, just last year we had a forum with the sheriff's department because we wanted to discourage him from using these programs and from impounding cars, because that was having a huge economic impact on these families. They're usually poor. So they can't afford to buy another car. They can't afford to lose the one that they have because of work and, you know, other things. And what we were hearing from the families was that, you know, in instances where the parents are arrested, oftentimes the children were left there to be picked up by someone else. I mean, that causes a lot of trauma for the children. And so we had, you know, during this forum, we had, a 5-year-old who was still crying, you know, recalling what had happened. And her mother told us that whenever she hears, like, the sirens from either the police or the ambulance, she kind of goes back to that place and begins crying. So it's, you know, they get traumatized. It affects very personally the children as well. So that's 287G for you. And Secure Communities comes in when these undocumented immigrants, and not only undocumented immigrants, just immigrants in general, find themselves in the local jails. Well, local police can share that information with ICE. And so you get then ICE agents coming in to the locality and picking you up and taking you to the detention centers. Now, the reason why I say it's secretive is because there's still a lot of aspects of it that we don't know how it's used. And just, I believe it was last year, there were several organizations around the country who were filing Freedom of Information Act requests on Tigger communities. The last thing that I heard is that it hasn't been answered. So there's still, you know, there's still a lot of questions with these programs.
And I had read a recent report that said at least 5,000 families, the parent had been taken away in one of these situations and then put in a detention center or deported. Mm-hmm. And so then the families are totally separated and the kids may not see their mother or father for years.
Right. Yeah, I mean, under Bush, what we would tend to see is very public, very large raids at workplaces. We would see, you know, ICE agents surrounding, for example, meatpacking places.
In Iowa, exactly,
in the Midwest. And what has happened under Obama is that we don't see that any longer. But yet, at the same time, the raids and the deportations have increased. Just this last fiscal year, there were close to 400,000 deportations, which brings the number to 1 million people being deported just under the Obama administration. What has happened and what we hear from these families and in the community is that they have moved from these very large and public raids to more kind of a down low. Usually they come, the ICE agents come to the community. It usually takes place during the night or the very morning when the people are going to work. And so obviously there's no cameras out there to let us see what's going on. And this separates family because one thing that, you know, oftentimes people don't understand is that Latino immigrant families are of mixed status. So you can have the mom be a U.S. citizen but married someone without papers, and maybe the children are also U.S. citizens, so they might be separated from their dad or both of their parents. So, this is a really traumatic event for them when it happens.
Breaks up families. It's mm-hmm. It's amazing that given the record number of deportations that Obama has been doing, that he's still angling for the Latino vote.
Right, and when he was campaigning his first time around, we were promised immigration reform the first year he was in office. So he's been in office for 3 years now. And during those 3 years, there have been points during his administration where the Latino support has just basically, you know, hit rock bottom. And at those, you know, in those moments, we see that Obama and his administration come out and try to entice us with something. So last summer, it was the Dream Act, you know, and we had thousands and thousands of undocumented students and youth coming out to the streets. There was even a march from Florida to Washington, D.C. of a few undocumented college students who really wanted to make it public, make not only their status, but the fact that there's a need for the Dream Act. In California, we also organized a campaign to get the Dream Act passed. But what we were saying was, we do want the Dream Act, but we want it without military strings attached. And we want it something that's broad enough so that all undocumented youth can eventually get their papers, get their green card. Because under the current version, you know, they're given a choice. You either finish college or you go into the military, and that's the only way that you can, you know, be granted your green card or your papers. And, you know, we look around and we see that it doesn't really matter if you have papers or not. It's just in general, it's getting hard to go to college. The fees are going up. Just this, just a few weeks ago, we had in California, some of the UC regions announced that they were going to increase the fees another 81%. you know. And at the same time, you know, financial aid is getting cut. A lot of the grants are getting cut. You know, and aside from that, for undocumented youth, when they come here, oftentimes they don't have, for example, the language skills to allow them to graduate from high school and then go on to college. So there's, you know, the barriers kind of pile up for them, and it's really difficult for them to actually get that college degree so that they can get their papers. So what it does is eventually it funnels them into the military, and that's the only way that they can gain their legalization. And we don't want that. We don't want our brothers and sisters, we don't want our children of any race, of any legal status, to be sent to other countries to die. We
don't. It's either this economic draft that you're talking about, mm-hmm. or it forces them into a permanent underclass.
Exactly. You know, and this has been occurring in other communities, in the Black community, for example, where we do get youth going into the military because that's the only way for them to then, when they return, if they return, get some money to go to college. And that's just completely unfair.
Mm-hmm. How do you try to bridge the two communities? Because there's been some history of hostility, mm-hmm. and tension between the African-American and Latino communities. You're an activist, you're an organizer. How do you try to bridge that?
Well, it is difficult. And there's no denying that there have been and continue to be some problems between the communities. And I think that's the case between most communities or most groups. There's a lack of understanding in terms of the Black and the Latino or Black and brown communities. What often happens, or what I've heard, is that we get, you know, Black workers saying, well, they are taking our jobs. You know, they're here and you know, they're kind of coming into the communities and taking our jobs. And again, you know, we have to look at the process of displacement that drives migration, but also look at the fact that these two communities share so much in common. We have in Northern California, for example, Black and brown communities coming together in the struggle against police violence and police brutality. In the community that I live, there are, you know, unfortunately, an increase in numbers of cases of police brutality, you know, youth getting murdered by police. And so this is a problem and an issue that has brought these two communities together. The thing here is to, you know, when there are common issues like that, to build that, to organize, and not just, you know, come together for an event, but continue the communication and continue collaborating, building some permanent structure so that there's solidarity there. But we share a lot in common, and we just, I think, need to talk to one another.
Well, that's going to have to be the last word. I think it's an important last word. We all need to talk to one another, mm-hmm. and build a real broad coalition for justice in this country. My guest today has been Alejandra Juarez. She's an immigrant rights activist from California. Alejandra, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for inviting me.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.